Podcasting worldwide from Vancouver, Canada. Welcome back to the Personal Process Podcast. The show that takes you through the growth, hardship, self-discovery, lessons, and stories of individuals who achieved success in their own personal path. Trust the process.
I want to get into the meat of it now.
Yeah. Hey, ask me your questions and I'll do my best to answer them as concisely as I can, which is probably not very concise.
No, for sure. So, you know, you're mentioning that you had the financial struggles and Bitcoin was a game changer for you. I want you to talk specifically about that because I know you talked about the fact that you invested in it and went up and down, but how did Bitcoin actually act as that game changer?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so for the first few years and I'm going to say that this is all hypothetical just because I'm not really sure about the legality of it. But the very first time I bought Bitcoin, I bought it on localbitcoins.com. Yep. And the method of buying it, I went into a US bank.
Yep.
And I gave the teller cash and said, deposit this to this account number. And then I took the receipt and I wrote the date and my local Bitcoin's username on it. And then I had to take a picture of it and send it to the guy on Local Bitcoins, who then sent me my Bitcoins. Dude, it felt so
Zoom.
Sketchy. I honestly, the whole time I'm in this bank, I'm like looking over my shoulder. Zoom. And I'm like half expecting some G-man to come up behind me and be like, And then I decided to start buying and selling Bitcoin on Local Bitcoins. And I didn't do it for a profit. Because again, I had a day job at the time. I did it because I thought it was a really interesting way to learn about Bitcoin and to meet other people who are interested in it. Ironically, I ended up getting immortalized for this. I have a friend of mine who's a science fiction author. I'll give a shout out to my friend, William Hertling. He wrote a science fiction series called Avogadro Corp. That's about an emergent AI. Avogadro is basically Google. In the book, it's sort of an analog of Google. And they inadvertently develop a strong AI it's a really interesting series. It's like a three-part series, highly recommended. After that, though, he wrote a book called Kill Process that's about a gal who works at a social media company that's basically Facebook, has a different name. But she works at a social media company, and she uses her access at this company to find men who are abusing their significant others, and then she kills them. And so she's basically a serial killer, but it's sort of like Dexter, right? Like she's killing only bad people. And so the book is called Kill Process. And in that book, there's a story thread in that book where she, again, this was written in like 2014, I think. So like you got to realize maybe 2015, something like that. So several years ago, back when the overall Bitcoin economy was much smaller. And so there's this story thread in the book where she manipulates the price of Bitcoin by buying a ton of it using this company's money that she works for. And she does that through a guy on Local Bitcoins. And the guy is named, in the book, the guy is named Dimmon, D-I-M-M-N, which stands for Danger is my middle name. And that's me. I'm that character in the book. And what's funny is Will told me that I guess I inspired that where there was a time where I'm sure he still does this, but I don't live in Portland, so I can't go anymore. But he used to do like a monthly gathering for writers, and we'd all just get together and have some beers and chat and just talk about craft and then just talk about really anything. And there was one time where we were meeting at the Kennedy School in Portland, which is this I don't know if you've ever been there. It's like this old school that got bought and turned into a bar. And so like all these different rooms in the school have like different, there's like a boiler room bar, for instance, where you can go and sit in the old boiler room and like have drinks and stuff. So we're there and I had my laptop with me and I got a trade request for Local Bitcoin trade. Mm. And so I actually met up with the guy there at the writer's group. I said, well, hey, I'm at Kennedy School right now, like come on by. And so he came by, bought some Bitcoin off of me. And I guess that transaction ended up inspiring Will to like include this scene in the book. So anyway, so to answer your question, for like a couple of years, I was, I think, the lowest percentage wise, right? Because I didn't take a profit at all. The only upcharge that I charged was the fee that I had to pay to buy the Bitcoin. So I was paying like a 1-2% fee at the time when I bought the Bitcoin.
Right.
And so when I would sell it to somebody else, I would only charge a 1% to 2% fee. Most everybody else in Portland was charging like 4 or 5%. So, I mean, I was undercutting them by quite a bit. Now, I didn't do a huge volume just because I had a day job. I wasn't trying to do it. I was really doing it more for fun. But I did that for like a couple of years. My wife and I took a road trip out back to Ohio to visit some of my friends in 2014. And I don't think we used an ATM once. I mean, I did local Bitcoin trades in cities along the way. I remember there was I did like a local Bitcoin trade in a hookah bar on Ohio State campus for like a few hundred bucks. And that few hundred bucks was like, that's all that we spent the entire time that we were in Ohio. So it's like, I didn't have to use my bank account at all for that, because I just sold a little bit of Bitcoin and, you know, that financed our trip. And so like it, you know, I think that trip was what kind of really opened my eyes to the potential of like, this could someday replace my bank account, right? Mm. Like here I am traveling thousands of miles away from home and I'm not using my bank at all. Now, ideally, it would have been great to be able to spend the Bitcoin directly, right? Mm. But we just weren't there yet. I mean, we're not there yet now. We're a little closer, but we definitely weren't there yet, you know, 6 years ago. But like that's just one example. I think, you know, for me, I think the biggest change though that Bitcoin has brought to me is like the thinking long term. I was thinking about it before we chatted today, right? It's sort of a joke about how people, it's kind of become a trope about like that interview question of like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I don't think that people ask that a lot during interviews anymore, only because I would suspect, I've never asked this question during an interview. I've held interviews before, but I've never really found much value in that question, because I feel like that the answers that you get are going to be mostly
Zoom.
And I think the reason for that is because most people, myself included, aren't great at thinking long-term, right? Like we're all very, you know, we're all very concerned about like the immediate needs of whatever's happening in our lives right now. And I mean, sometimes you might think a year down the line, maybe for planning I just got married a year ago and we spent a year and a half planning the wedding. So like there are some occasions where I think we are better at long-term planning, but on the whole, we think very short-term as a species. Yeah. And I think as a result of that, it's a great example is like when I panic sold that for, you know, when I first got into Bitcoin, because I wasn't thinking in a long-term time frame. I was thinking like, I'm going to buy this
Zoom
at $600 and it's going right back up to $1,300 and I'm going to be rich. Every dollar I put in is going to turn into two.
Yeah.
Well, when you go into something with that kind of mindset and then it doesn't work out, I mean, that's panic inducing, man. Like you're, you know, because you haven't made a plan, because you haven't, you know, because you have not really thought through all the potentials of how that might go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, so to give you an example of like how my mindset has changed, you know, several years ago when it dropped by half, I panic sold. In March of this year, on March 13th, Bitcoin dropped to below $4,000. From like, I think it was over 9,000 prior to that, like a day or two before. I bought Bitcoin at 3860. I bought some, I didn't sell any, I bought some. And so that's like a complete reversal of attitude between now and, you know, whatever, 6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
And the reason why though, is because I have lived through it. Look, man, I think like, for me, I think every day that Bitcoin continues, to me, that only makes it more and more inevitable that it's here to stay and that it will absolutely dominate the financial world. I think that, dominate. You know, oh, absolutely. Wow. Are you familiar with Grey Goo in like a nanotechnology context?
No, I'm not.
That's Grey Goo is like a
conductor or something.
Well, Grey Goo is like a, we'll call it a science fiction worst case scenario, right? Because we don't really have functional nanotechnology yet. But Grey Goo is like a worst case scenario envisioned for nanotechnology where, you know, you develop a self-replicating nanotech that consumes and creates new nanotech, right? And if you don't do that correctly, there is a possibility that it could literally consume the entire planet in a swarming Grey Goo of nanotechnology that it just expands and consumes everything in its path until there's just nothing left except for the gray goo.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is the gray goo of the financial system.
Hmm. In a positive light, though.
Well, sort of. I mean, I guess so. I guess the one difference is that, you know, Bitcoin itself is not self-replicating. I think the idea of Bitcoin, though, is self-replicating. Like the cat is out of the bag, I guess you could say at this point. I don't think a lot. I mean, even now, right? I think a lot of people know they know of Bitcoin, right? Like if mm-hmm. I said, "Have you heard of Bitcoin?" I think most people, not everybody, but most people at this point would say yes. I like to ask a follow-up question, though, of like, what do you think Bitcoin is?
True.
Almost nobody gets that right.
So let me ask you a question, Dan. What do you think Bitcoin is?
I was hoping you would ask that. So I'm actually going to self-promote here for a quick second before I answer the question. I actually presented a speech. I think I mentioned earlier, I've been a Toastmaster for the last 2 years. And I really have found a lot of value in that. It's improved my public speaking. It's made me feel a lot more confident when in front of crowds. I feel like that my leadership and time management skills have improved. One thing that I want to use Toastmasters for and have started to do that is I love explaining technology to people, right? I come from like a support background. So my early career, I spent a lot of time explaining technical concepts to lay persons. And I gave a speech a few months ago now, I want to say probably like June, July. I gave a speech in my Toastmasters group titled, "What is Bitcoin?" And the reason that I wanted to do this is because, you know, I love my Toastmasters group. I'm not trying to knock them, but the average age of that group is probably like 50, 55 years old.
Yeah.
It's not a young group. At 40 years old, I think I'm one of the young, I'm probably one of the top like five younger people in the group. And so I kind of look at that as a challenge, right? Because like you're talking to a group of older folks who aren't, you know, historically maybe the most technologically savvy. And so that was sort of the challenge to me, was to present this in a way that
they can understand.
That they can understand. And I think that, you know, that people got it. So look, I mean, at the end of the day, I think the Bitcoin white paper abstract is the best example of just an elevator pitch of Bitcoin. And I'll read it verbatim just so I don't mangle it or anything. The abstract of the Bitcoin white paper, which by the way, I suggest that everybody reads. I'm pretty sure the URL for it is just bitcoin.org/bitcoin.pdf. The abstract states that Bitcoin is a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash that would allow for online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. And that's really it. I mean, we could get a lot more in depth. Honestly, we could spend two entire hours talking about just what is Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I feel like I could probably spend 2 hours talking about that. At the end of the day, though, it's like the internet, man. Like, I don't think that, do you have any idea like how TCP/IP and DNS works on the internet?
I don't. I will stroke my beard like I do, though.
Right. Oh, yes. Yeah. But you use the internet every day, right?
Yep.
You use the internet almost every day, like most of us do. Most people have no idea how the internet works. Hell, I barely do. And I've spent 20 years working in IT. But we still use it every day. And it has absolutely changed the landscape of the entire world, right?
Yep.
Economically, socially. Bitcoin will be the same thing, man. Like, I think right now, because it's still so new, like, you know, when I first started using the internet, it's a great example. I mean, like dialing up into, or like a BBS, for instance, dialing into a BBS and then accessing like a forum, or dialing into Freenet and accessing a web page on links. I don't know that there are many people that could do that today, even with the like immersion of technology that we have, just because it's so foreign to like where we are now in the current implementation of those technologies. Bitcoin 10 years from now will be so similar. I mean, there's like, you'll look back on the process for how to do things right now and just laugh about like how overly complex it all is. Like there is still, even 12 years in, a very high technical barrier of entry to do Bitcoin right, to do it right, right? If we're talking about like self-custody, not leaving it on an exchange, setting up a hardware wallet, having good operational security, those things are not things that people normally think about, and rightly so, because they're not daily things that we run into.
Dan, to even go a bit further, not even only how to set it up right, how to even set it up, period. You know,
well, like, and so that, yeah. So I'm gonna I'll give a shout out. So I created a I did create a website that's like sort of a we'll call it a corollary to that presentation that I gave. Sure. And it's basically just an introduction to Bitcoin site where I've curated a few links. Like my favorite one on there that I'll give a shout out to. There's a guy named Jameson Lopp who he's a big Bitcoin guy. He's a founder of a company called Casa that's well known in the space. He has a great website that's called Getting Started with Bitcoin that's linked on this page. And I mean, it's probably dozens, maybe even hundreds of hours of material on that website. So like if you have listeners that are looking to go down that rabbit hole, like there are definitely good resources out there. And I've tried really hard to find them and curate them because there are a lot of scammers in the space. There are a lot of people that, you know, they're going to try and draw you in so they can give you a sales pitch. I hate that kind of
Zoom.
And so I've tried to stay away from it and find people that are also staying away from it. But that website is 10binary.io/Bitcoin. It's super ugly right now. Like it has no CSS. It's literally just like a list of links. I do plan on cleaning it up at some point, but there's a lot of good stuff there. And at the bottom, there are actually some links for different places where you can buy Bitcoin. They are referral links. You don't have to use them though. I honestly don't care. It's like 10 bucks in Bitcoin. I'm not going to cry if I don't get it. But if you want to use those referral links, you can. And then there's a link there too about how to secure your wallet. But honestly, too, beyond that, if you have any listeners that are, you know, that go through this episode and they're like, man, I want to find out more about Bitcoin, totally welcome to reach out to me. I'm at No One Danger on Twitter. I honestly love answering questions about Bitcoin. That's why I run a monthly Bitcoin meetup group here in my town. That's why I talk about it so much. That's why I have a big poster of it on my wall.
Yeah, you know,
I'm always happy to talk about it. But honestly, how to get into Bitcoin is easier than ever now. I mean, if you don't care about self-custody, about putting it on a hardware wallet, which in my opinion, you should, but again, there are plenty of people that don't. If you don't care about that and you're just going to leave it on an exchange account, sign up for, you know, Cash App, Coinbase, Gemini, any of those sites, you can buy Bitcoin for a very low fee. You can buy, I know on Cash App and Coinbase, I'm not sure about Gemini, but I know on the first two, you can buy it with a credit card even, which, you know, again, I don't really suggest, but there are plenty of people that do. Credit card, bank account, wire transfer, you know, there are so many different ways to buy it now. And you know, these sites like Cash App is owned by Square. Coinbase is one of the largest exchanges in the world. Gemini, same thing, one of the largest exchanges in the world. Coinbase and Gemini both do their banking services through Chase. They're like, you know, legit. Like,
right.
There are fewer and fewer fly-by-night companies in this space, fortunately, by the day. And so that's been nice to see. But
So Dan, let me ask you a question. I'm not sure if you had sales experience, but I'm going to assume you've had. And as a strong advocate of Bitcoin, I hope that it can at least be a little bit easier for this question. So I'm a podcaster. I don't really, you know, I'm kind of that typical person who knows Bitcoin, but doesn't really know Bitcoin, that just thinks, you know, it's for illegal substances, you know, really crazy, weird stuff. Well, not weird stuff, but, you know, things that you wouldn't find on the normal internet.
Sure.
Why should I use Bitcoin, and what benefits could I get from it other than anonymity?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think there's a common misconception that Bitcoin is anonymous. It's not. Bitcoin is pseudonymous. Yeah, Bitcoin is pseudonymous, which, I mean, it's a minor distinction, right? But really what it comes down to is the entire point of Bitcoin is that it is a distributed ledger. So every Bitcoin node, which I've got a little Raspberry Pi over here that's running a node, every single node has a complete copy of the Bitcoin blockchain, which is, the blockchain is just a fancy way to say it. It's like literally
a ledger.
It is a list of every single Bitcoin transaction since January 2009. That's it. That's all it is. And so that's like 300 gigs of data at this point, because we're talking about, you know, 12 years of transactions. And so you've basically got every single Bitcoin node, which there are, I don't even know. I mean, there's at least 20,000 known nodes. There are ways to sort of obfuscate whether or not you're running a node. It's estimated that I mean, there are some estimates that there are over 100,000 Bitcoin nodes spread out around the world.
Wow.
Every single copy of those has that complete list of transactions of, you know, this wallet sent this amount of Bitcoin to this wallet. Now, the wallet addresses, that's why we say it's pseudonymous, right? Because I can have a wallet address that you may not have any idea that it's my wallet address. There are ways to like deobfuscate that though. Like for instance, if I send money to my Coinbase account, because Coinbase knows who I am, because they have to abide by know your customer laws, thanks to the government, they have like a scan of my ID and a picture of me holding it next to my face. So like they know who I am. If I transfer money from a wallet to my Coinbase account, it doesn't necessarily prove that I owned that wallet, but we can say that it's related, right?
Sure.
And if I wanted to see where the money from that wallet came from, all I have to do is you can go, if you type in, go to Google and type in Bitcoin Block Explorer, there are websites where you can search the entire blockchain. So you can take a transaction ID, you can take a wallet address, and punch it into this website, and it'll show you, I mean, you can look at the entire history. I actually had a job early this year, very briefly. I worked for a company called CipherTrace. That's their entire business model. They actually do Bitcoin analytics and forensics. They work with governments, law enforcement, private entities to track funds on the blockchain. Like at one point, able to find out who is associated with a wallet, you can actually see everything. Now, again, there are ways to obfuscate that. There's like coin mixing. There's Whirlpool. There are a few different ways that you can kind of obfuscate those trails. But if you're not doing any of that stuff, and you send money from your Coinbase account to Al Qaeda, you're gonna get busted for that. Like that's a very that's an easy thing to work out. So yeah. Bitcoin is not anonymous, but it does. So how it can be anonymous though? Let's say that I don't use any of those exchange services. And let's say that I just download a wallet app on my phone and create a Bitcoin wallet. That is effectively anonymous as long as you don't do anything to link it with your real identity. So a few areas where that might come in handy. I can't even really think of a specific company right now because there have been so many. But think about all the companies that you've heard about that have had credit card data breached, right? Hmm. So you do business with a company, you give them your credit card, whether it's for a one-time transaction or recurring or whatever, but you give them your credit card number, they keep that credit card number on file. And at that point, you are essentially trusting that they are going to be a good steward of that information. Unfortunately, as history has proven, many times that does not happen. Unfortunately, once that information is out, it's sort of like the same thing kind as earlier, the cat's out of the bag, right? You can't undo it once it's on the internet. And so Bitcoin allows though for a system where, like a good example, I was, when I lived in Portland for the last 2 years that I lived there, I was a member of a makerspace. I don't know if you're familiar with the makerspace concept. You go in and use,
kind of like 3D engineer printer. Your own things and test it out.
Exactly. Yep. You got like vinyl cutters, laser printers, or laser cutters, 3D printers. So I paid $40 a month. For that membership. But I did not want to set up a recurring payment on a credit card. I don't like those. I try to avoid them if I can.
Yep, 100%.
And fortunately, the owner of Control H, the makerspace in Portland, John, the owner, was very open to accepting Bitcoin. And so it allows for, so like, I guess you could think of it as like push versus pull, right? Like the traditional payment model for a recurring system, I give you my credit card and you pull the payment from me every month, right? Now that presents all kinds of challenges. Like I had to deal with something with Equifax early this year where I signed up with like credit monitoring for them and then I canceled it during the free trial and then they kept billing me. It was a huge hassle, man. I had to contact the freaking, I had to contact like my state government because like they kept billing me and wouldn't stop. And so I basically contacted like, I don't remember the name. It's like I contacted like the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. I contacted several regulatory agencies. And finally, after doing that, I was able to get Equifax to stop billing my credit card every month for this like $25 a month. Before that though, every time they'd bill it, I'd have to log into American Express, fill out a dispute with them, go through this whole rigmarole, right? And I mean, the whole process, it was like a 2 or 3 month long process where, you know, they just kept billing me this Zoom, even though I had already canceled it until they finally got their stuff together. That could literally never happen in Bitcoin because instead of a pull model where you're pulling the money from me, I am the only one that can spend money out of my Bitcoin wallet. You can't just be like, if you have my Bitcoin wallet address, you can't do Zoom with it except see how much money I have, how much Bitcoin I have in that specific wallet address. you know, it's not like with a credit card. Once you have that details, then you can just take money all you want. Yep. And then, I mean, it's, you know, up to the credit limit, obviously.
Yeah.
That's a huge game changer, man. Like,
that is.
I mean, also, you know, there's no personal data that's associated with that, right? Like when you have my credit
other than card, that one picture, you know, for that company, yeah.
You know my name, you know my credit card number, you know my zip code, you might even know my home address, right? Like, because sometimes they not only require a zip code, but they require your full billing address. Yep. So it's like multiple pieces of PII that get included with that. It's not just a credit card number. It's like part of your identity. And that's why, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're dealing with so many issues with identity theft, because there are all these data points for all these people, and they're all just out there waiting to be, you know, breached by somebody who then sells them on the dark net. And so,
it's crazy.
It fixes that problem.
It does. Dan, before we keep going, there's a lot of points I want to just add on. So, you know, you were mentioning earlier that there are some Bitcoin wallets, or I don't know if that was a correct term, but that actually have you take the picture with your identity card. Wouldn't that be, even with that, that's probably a little bit less of a compromise. Is that correct? Compared to going through a credit card and having every single piece of data and having it open.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it depends, right? If you're talking about for the purposes of identity theft, I mean, like, you know, there's a picture of me on, and exchange, by the way, would be the proper word. On an exchange, you have a Bitcoin wallet. Right. Mm-hmm. But a Bitcoin wallet is just basically it's a cryptographically secured store for the credentials that allow you to access your Bitcoin. It's complicated, right? Your wallet is not actually holding any Bitcoin.
Yeah.
As weird as it sounds, your wallet is holding the private keys that allow you to move that Bitcoin. It's kind of a minor distinction. But anyway, and an exchange is a service that like Coinbase is an exchange. Most exchanges also offer wallets, or I would say all exchanges also offer wallets, because you have to have some way to store the Bitcoin that you purchase. Sure. But the primary point of Coinbase, at least to me, I don't use Coinbase to store any Bitcoin. I just use it to buy Bitcoin. And then as soon as I can move it off the platform into a wallet that I control. And when I say control, we're talking about, again, the private keys, right? Because like on a Coinbase wallet, you don't have any way to access the private keys for that wallet. Coinbase controls them.
Sure.
On a hardware wallet or like a software wallet that you'd run on your phone or your computer. Like I have Wasabi wallet on my computer. That's a software wallet. I control the keys to that though. There's like a file on my computer that contains the cryptographic private key that allows me to access my wallet.
Interesting.
And so because I'm the only one that has that, nobody on earth, like if I kept money in Coinbase, I don't think they would do this because they're a reputable company, right? They could just take it if they wanted to, or maybe, I mean, let's say the government comes to them and says, "Hey, you know, we want you to lock these funds because we think this guy is money laundering
or a terrorist or something."
I mean, whether or not that's true, right? Like, unfortunately, I think, and this is probably a broader discussion, but you know, you ask about like the benefits of Bitcoin. I think that, and it goes way beyond our lives, right? Like, I mean, this is going back like decades, maybe even hundreds of years, but like money has been weaponized, man. Look at the economic embargoes that the United States has levied on Cuba, Iran, Russia, North Korea.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, you know, do I like any of those governments? No, absolutely not. But at the end of the day, the financial system, I don't think should be used as a weapon. And it absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
The reason it's used as a weapon is because they can. I mean, the United States, the US dollar is the global reserve currency. We have an immense amount of power that comes along with that.
Sure.
I think that, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand with the military might. I don't know that we would have such a strong military in this country if we didn't have the status that we have as the global reserve currency, because everybody in the world right now anyway wants US dollars. I don't know that that'll always be that way. And I feel like that, you know, especially as somebody who has personally been frozen out of the financial system, granted for a limited amount of time, thankfully, but I've been there, I've lived that life and it sucks.
Yeah.
And the idea that there is literally no way, you cannot stop somebody from making a Bitcoin wallet. You don't even need access to the internet. Like I have a hardware wallet here. It's called a cold card that you can generate a Bitcoin wallet using dice. You roll dice and write down the numbers, and those numbers are then used to crunch your private key. You do not need to be connected to the internet at all. Nobody can stop me from doing that. I mean, the only way you could stop me would be to kill me or to steal the hardware wallet. And even then, even if you stole the hardware wallet, there are still ways. I mean, there are programs that you can download unless you destroy every computer in the world and every mobile phone.
The whole network, yeah. Man, that's insane.
There is no way to freeze somebody out of the Bitcoin network. Now, there are ways to freeze them out of these centralized exchanges, right? Like Coinbase can close your account. But Coinbase isn't Bitcoin. Coinbase is just a third-party actor that is operating on the Bitcoin network. The actual Bitcoin protocol network itself, there's no way to stop anybody from using it. And that, I mean, I don't think words can even really convey how powerful that is. I think only history will convey. I think it's one of those things that I think that, you know, if you would ask somebody in the 80s to even the 90s, man, like, Zoom. What was it? Paul Krugman is sort of well known to this day as he's like universally derided for his comment in the late 90s that the internet will have no more economic impact than the fax machine. I don't know that I've ever heard a more wrong prediction in my lifetime. And there are people that thought that about the internet as late as the 90s, man. So like, when I hear people naysaying Bitcoin, I honestly just kind of chuckle. I'll be happy to try and talk to people about why I think it's important. And I'm always down to like debate with people and change their minds.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, I mean, you can't force somebody to do it, to do anything. I have a feeling though, that, you know, you hear people talk about like, oh man, I wish I had bought Bitcoin when it was, you know, $1, $20, $200.
Or like a thousandth of a cent.
I guarantee you, my friend, 10 years from now, there are going to be people that are saying, man, I wish I had bought Bitcoin at 20K in 2020. I guarantee it.
I agree.
If I were a betting man, I would bet money on it. But I'm not a betting man. I'd rather spend that money on Bitcoin. So,
well, I mean, you're showing that you are a betting man, right? Because you're putting that money down on Bitcoin, right? So, like, your belief is there for sure.
Yeah, you know? I think, like... I don't consider myself a very betting person, just for the record. We have we live by,
I guess, belief would be a better word.
Maybe. I mean, we live by a Native American reservation here. Right. And so they have a casino and we actually go there, I'd say probably about once a month. We normally go just for food though. They have amazing food. But every so often my wife and I'll take like $20 each and we'll play the slots, you know, like I don't really gamble though, man. I don't consider myself a betting guy. I think I probably bought maybe 10 lottery tickets in my entire lifetime, you know, just sort of as a, like, I, you know, just kind a lark. So I don't consider myself highly, like a highly risky person in that regard. Mm. I will say though, that I think like, yes, to some sense it is belief, but then also, man, I think there comes a certain point where if you've been in this space long enough, it goes beyond belief to just like personal lived experience. I mean, like I said, I've seen Bitcoin go from $200 to $20,000. I've seen it go 100x within my time involved. And then I've seen it go, you know, I've seen it drop back down to below $4,000 and then go back up to that, you know, previous high. And I am absolutely convinced that it will exceed that previous high in 2021. I guess I would agree that there's some degree of belief there, but it's like, I would say it's a mix of like belief plus just, I think 6 years ago, it would have been 100% belief. Absolutely. Mm. Like when I was buying any Bitcoin, like 5-6 years ago, 100% belief. I'd say at this point, it's at least a 50-50 split of just like, I believe it's going to go higher, but I've also seen just like the crazy price action that it's done.
Yeah.
Now I want to point out too, I always like to call out when we're talking about Bitcoin price. I mean, I've been in the space long enough and I've tried to learn a lot about it. At this point, I feel really confident in saying that if you are willing to take the time to learn about Bitcoin, the price is like the least interesting thing about it.
Really?
Yeah. I've made money. Sure. Yeah. I've made money. It's great. Like whatever. Money's awesome. I especially love that with Bitcoin, I feel like that, you know, of all the ways in the world to make money, I feel like that with Bitcoin, there's like maybe a little less exploitation, right? Mm. I'm not exploiting anybody's labor to make any money, or, you know, I'm not like fooling anybody or doing anything shady, or like all I'm doing is buying Bitcoin that's created by, you know, miners crunching numbers. Like, I guess you could argue that there's maybe an environmental impact. I think even that is a little overblown. I've seen a lot of stuff talking about like the energy footprint that's used by the Bitcoin mining network. But what I think a lot of those articles fail to take into account is that there is a huge competition among Bitcoin miners to find the cheapest, most efficient power available, which tends to be renewable energy. So like, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, even compare it to what you're working against, right? Like a typical bank, they still have computers. Sure. They still have manpower. They still have to have chairs. They have to have buildings. They have their own
or gold. Ways. I mean, let's talk about gold, man. Like, you know, moving $1 billion worth of gold versus $1 billion worth of Bitcoin.
Which easy one's choice. Easier? Yeah.
I mean, it's not even a competition, man. That's absolutely. Like asking, you know, that's like asking who's going to win in this race between my Bugatti Veyron and my 12-speed mountain bike.
Yeah. No, that's very true. So, Dan, let me kind of bring you back a little bit. You know, you were mentioning earlier that the government may have access to stop your Bitcoin, but then after you're mentioning that they kind of don't. And I think I missed that connection. Do you mind kind of just talking a little bit about that?
Sure. So like the real strength of Bitcoin, in my opinion, is this decentralization, right? There is no central authority. There's nobody for the government to shut down. That's by right. design, by the way. Like if you look at the history of Satoshi Nakamoto, which is the pseudonym of the person who created person or group.
Lots of documentaries on him too.
I believe it was an individual. I'm strongly of the opinion that it was one guy. Yeah. I think that this was the epitome of his life's work.
Yeah.
Like I think he spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I think he also spent a lot of time learning about the history of money in this country. And the reason that I say that is because like, so when Satoshi registered Bitcoin.org, he used a service to register it that is fully anonymous. Like I want to say it's called Anonymous Speech is the name of the website. But basically, so like you can use private whois when you register a website, but the registrar that you register the site with, they still know who you are, right? Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, this
service, Anonymous Speech, I don't know if they still even operate, but what they used to do is you could send them 15, 20 bucks in the mail in cash, and then they register the website for you. And that's the service that he used to register this website. Like he put so much thought from the very beginning into making sure that nobody would ever find out who he was. And the reason that he did that, if you're not familiar with this, I encourage you to look it up. And I would encourage the same for all of your listeners. Look up, go to Google and type in Liberty dollar alternate currency. Make sure to do alternate currency on the end because there's a Liberty dollar that's like a US minted coin, but you're specifically looking for the alternate currency. And it is the Liberty dollar is a private currency that was created here in the States. I'm not super familiar with it because I was never involved, but it's my understanding that it was basically like a gold backed private currency.
Mm.
And the government shut them down hard. Not only did they shut them down, they confiscated all their money.
Wow.
And that's not the first time that the government has done something like that, right? Like, I mean, first of all, we have a huge issue in this country of civil forfeiture, right? Where the government will just come in and say, hey, we think you're doing a bad thing. We think you're, you know, dealing drugs, laundering money, whatever, you know? So we're just gonna take that all. We're gonna take all your money. And there are numerous stories about that, man. Type in like civil forfeiture US in the States. There was a story, I think last year, about a guy who was flying, you know, within the States, right? Like we're not even talking about leaving the country. We're talking about just staying in America, but flying from one state to another, went through TSA went through airport security with like, I don't even remember. It was like 20, 30, 40,000 bucks, something like that. Like a decent amount of money, but like certainly not like, I mean, when I think of people laundering money, I'm thinking like millions of bucks type of thing, you know?
Yep.
This guy went through with basically his life savings in cash and the government took it from him.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, unfortunately, it sort of goes against like the well-established or sort of well-understood precept in this country of innocent until proven guilty, right? Because what the government is essentially doing is they're saying, we think you're guilty, so we're going to take this money.
Yep.
And now it's up to you to prove that you're innocent, which by the way, that requires a lawyer, which by the way, requires money, which by the way, you have none of now because we stole it all from you. So it's sort of an interesting catch 22, right? It's like cutting somebody's leg off and then
thinking
about how they, you know, how their time in the quarter mile went down.
Yep.
You know, and I mean, it is absolutely mind boggling that we allow that kind of thing to happen, but that's where we are as a country. If you go back even further, though, if you go back to the, I think it was in the, I can't remember if it was in the 30s or the 40s. I want to say it was called Executive Order 6133. Basically, if you just go to Google and type in FDR gold confiscation, you'll find all kinds of stuff written about how, you know, they, the U.S. government basically put out an executive order saying you need to, all private citizens must turn in their gold. And the penalty, if you, and if you failed to comply, the penalty was like $10,000 fine, which, I mean, again, I don't even know what that would be in today's money, like some insane amount of money, I'm sure. And like time in prison. And so, you know, there are plenty of precedences, plenty of precedents in this, in this country of the government just outright robbing from people and properly. So to go back to your question. Okay. So here's where the danger comes in, right? Bitcoin itself is decentralized. There's no Bitcoin company or offices that the government can raid. There's no one Bitcoin server, central server that the governments can shut down. I mean, technically Bitcoin Core's code is hosted on GitHub. So I guess, like, you know, it would cause some issues, we'll say, if the government came into GitHub and forced them to shut down the Bitcoin Core repo. However, that would be very temporary, right? First of all, the existing Bitcoin network, like the software, all that GitHub is the repository for the software if you want to install it. If you already have it running, it's like it would have zero impact on the existing Bitcoin network, and it would have zero long-term impact, because I'm sure that if that were to happen, the obvious response would be to build a decentralized GitHub to host Bitcoin Core code. And that would absolutely be done very quickly. I'm certain of it. So I think, you know, because of that, I doubt that the government would even go that route, because what's the point? Like, at best, you'd be giving it a paper cut, right? And you're just going to put a Band-Aid on it and go on with your life.
And you're also going to create that fury.
You get a bit of a Streisand effect there, right? Like, I think that, you know, I think the smartest thing for the government to do would just be to ignore Bitcoin. I think that if they try to regulate it, first of all, apparently in 2018, Trump told Mnuchin that I want you to stop Bitcoin. This was like 2 years
really?
Ago. Yeah. And you know what Mnuchin said?
What did he say?
Said we can't. There's, I mean, like, that's the thing. They could deal a serious blow to Bitcoin. Absolutely. Yeah. They could probably deal numerous serious blows to Bitcoin that would set it back by years. It would not destroy it, though. I am confident at this point that, I mean, so here's the only scenario. There are only two scenarios, actually, that I can see Bitcoin completely failing.
Mm.
Yeah, we'll say two, and then I'll say two and a half, and I'll say what the half one is. So the first one is complete and utter apocalyptic breakdown of society, where, I mean, we're talking like zombie apocalypse, global EMP from like a massive solar flare, something that throws the entire planet all at once back into the Stone Age. That's one scenario. Another scenario, and even this, I don't know that it would completely kill it, but another scenario that could possibly kill Bitcoin would be every government, and I mean every government on the entire planet, agreeing to cooperate to shut down every Bitcoin miner they can find, every third-party Bitcoin centralized service they can find, and arrest every Bitcoin holder that they can find. If every government on Earth agreed to do those things and cooperated together to accomplish them, then I think that could kill Bitcoin. Now, that would require a degree of collusion, of friendship, of common goal between countries that we have never before seen in all of human history. And so the likelihood of that happening, I would think that it's more likely that aliens are going to land on the White House, on the South Lawn of the White House. You know, like, I just don't see that happening. Now, two and a half, the other scenario that I think could maybe kill Bitcoin would be some kind of serious technical flaw in the protocol itself. Even that, though, I mean, there was a bug. So I think it's important to note that in 12 years of Bitcoin's history, there has not been a single bug that resulted in funds being stolen from somebody else, right? Mm. Every Bitcoin hack that you've heard about, every time you've heard about, oh, the, you know, X number of Bitcoins were stolen, every single one of those instances has been a centralized third-party exchange, which, by the way, to quickly answer the question you asked earlier, that's what goes back to how could the government shut down your Bitcoin transaction? If you're using like Coinbase or some kind of centralized exchange, the government could come in and say, hey, stop that person from transacting, freeze their funds. In that scenario, again, right, because going back to what we talked about earlier, because in that scenario, Coinbase would be the one who holds the private keys.
Yep.
Because they hold the private keys, they control what happens with that money.
Sorry to cut you off, Dan. So is that why you're mentioning to go on to like your own local hardware disk?
That's one reason. I mean, there are a few reasons, right? Like, but that's, I'd say, a big one. I mean, there's a saying in the space. It's NYK, NYC is the abbreviation. Stands for not your keys, not your coin. I also like to call it not your keys, not your condo, right? Because that's a better way to, the reason I say not your keys, not your condo is because I think that's a little more of like a,
not your house.
More people can relate to that, right? Like if you don't have the keys to the condo, that's not your condo. And if you've made copies of that key and given it to other people, or if you give that key to somebody else, well,
that's such a good analogy.
What's that saying? Possession is 9/10 of ownership. So like, I mean, that's, I think, why it's the whole point of Bitcoin, man. Like, I mean, so going back, it's like Satoshi, the reason I mentioned gold confiscation, by the way, I forgot to tie that all together. Satoshi picked when he registered for a forum account on bitcointalk.com, the birth date that he chose was the date that executive order was released, the day, not the year. So it was like April, whatever, was the day that he picked. But then the year that he picked was 1971, which I don't know if you know the significance of that. I think it was 71, it might be 72. But that was when Nixon finally fully removed the US from the gold standard. So like, Satoshi, maybe it's a coincidence that maybe that really is his birthday, but I don't think so. The guy was very smart, and he clearly knew what he was doing, and he clearly knew the history of previous attempts of people trying to do similar things to create an alternative financial system. He knew that would be bringing some heat down on him potentially. In fact, he stepped away from the Bitcoin project altogether when one of the other developers, right? Because the project had grown at that point, there were several developers who were working with it. One of the developers accepted an invitation to speak at the CIA about Bitcoin. CIA wanted to ask him questions about Bitcoin. And it wasn't immediately after that, but like within a few weeks after that, Satoshi had that was his last post. Like,
well, I mean, he saw the history, right?
Right. And I think, you know, I think he kind of knew that maybe that I think there's a lot of interest in finding out who he is. And I hope that we never do.
Yeah. And, you know, so for those of us who don't know, it's, you know, Bitcoin, the founder, Satoshi, he's anonymous. And not the cyber internet group that's done a lot of advocacy work, but, you know, like no one knows who he is. And keep in mind, like the people that are in Bitcoin usually have a lot more advanced technical skills compared to the lay public. So if they can't find them, realistically, no one can. And, you know, just the fact that he made this decentralized network, it's like, it's incredible. And, you know, just kind of talking about previous themes that we were talking about here, Dan, you know, money is power. But if there's a way to distribute money to the whole world, that power goes away. And I think maybe I'm speculating here, but maybe that's why Trump wanted to shut it down, because, you know, he's a powerful person. He's president of the free world, quote unquote. And, you know, it's
for another 45 one days. Just
to clear out. So, one more days. Is that it?
I said it's for another 45 days.
Okay. 45 days. Yeah. And then we got Biden coming in, and, you know, it's just one way to keep control on people. And, you know, control to some degree, I think, is necessary. But I think just in the past couple of years, there's been a lot of distrust. I mean, you're mentioning that example with police coming in and taking over your possessions for, I think, you know, and I actually saw a documentary and I was kind of blown away when I heard it was in Washington as well. There was an example where an individual couple who were living in a state, I believe it was Washington, maybe California, but the state allows consumption of marijuana and it allows growth of marijuana. And what they end up finding out is that, you know, the cops came through, they saw like maybe a little bit of marijuana, just, you know, personal consumption amount, but they took away their whole property just for that. And then they were saying, We think you're growing it or something. And, you know, I was watching this and like, I don't even know what to think. I was just watching this and it hit me so deeply. And I'm not even getting my property taken away. And, you know, I think in Canada, it's a little bit more, I don't know about the financial law specifically, but, you know, this kind of stuff is not even heard about, you know, and I don't know if it's possible. And maybe I just haven't had that experience and I'm very thankful
for
it.
It's barely talked about here. I mean, it happens here in this country barely gets talked about. It's like our media, they don't spend a lot of time talking about that kind of stuff. It's like
it's crazy.
If you seek it out, right? Like, I mean, I'm not a libertarian myself, but like I have some libertarian leanings, I guess you could say. Like I am a big advocate for just being left alone, you know, unless I'm infringing on somebody else's rights. I guess you could call that libertarian.
Yeah.
And you know, not so much now, but I would say definitely 7 years ago when I first got into Bitcoin, it was very heavily dominated by libertarian minded people like that. And there's still a pretty big presence today.
Right.
I think just because of what Bitcoin represents, right? Like I think the best description that I've heard of Bitcoin is that it is the first, let me find a good way to phrase this. It is the, at least as far as I know, it is the only way to really achieve true financial sovereignty, right? Like the idea that like only I control this money. I mean, you could kind of do it with gold. Like I have a little bit of gold. I don't knock precious metals. I mean, I have a little bit of gold. I have a little bit of silver.
Sure, diversified.
Ultimately though, at the end of the day, if there's ever an emergency situation where we need to get the hell out of
loop,
like we've talked about it, man, we've talked about, you know, if it goes bad, we were 10 minutes from the Canadian border, you know, like if things ever get bad, we'll go up there and try and claim, you know, refugee status or something. At that point, it's like, I would feel a lot more comfortable traveling with my seed phrase, right? Because my hardware wallet, I don't even need the physical wallet. I mean, ideally I would take it with me if I could, but I have a 24 word seed phrase that I can use to restore that wallet. And I don't even need the same device, by the way. I can use a different device. It's a standard. It's like a standardized thing, right? So those same 24 words I can use to restore my Bitcoin wallet on any wallet that supports that it's called BIP38 standard. BIP38 stands for Bitcoin Improvement Protocol or Bitcoin Improvement Proposal. And so BIP38 was an improvement proposal to Bitcoin that said, hey, backing up wallets is really hard. What we should do, because prior to seed words, you used to have to write down, it was like a super long string of like random alphanumeric shit, right? The BIP38 protocol basically gives a list of like, I think it's like a list of like 1,000 to 2,000 words, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you got to realize when you're making 24 combinations of those, I don't remember exactly what the exponential number is, but it's something like the number of possibilities. It's like more than the number of grains of sand on the planet Earth. Like it's insane that it would be impossible to guess. It would take billions of years for the fastest computers in the world to guess, you know, your private seed phrase. And so I can take that seed phrase. I can write it down on paper. I can etch it onto metal. I can memorize it, which I don't really recommend. I have memory, but if you have a great memory, sure. I mean, if it's just maybe for something like going across the border, you know, properly secured, my Bitcoin can never be taken from me. The worst that could ever happen, right? The worst that could ever happen is that somebody kills me and then my Bitcoin is gone forever. Or it's at least inaccessible forever. It's not really gone, right? It still exists, but it's like locked. And in fact, there are some estimates that as many as like 2 to 3 million Bitcoin, which keep in mind, there's only 18.5 million Bitcoin in existence right now in general. And there will only ever be at most 21 million. And that won't happen until like 2140. Right. Yep. So we're talking about like possibly as much as 10 to 20% of the existing Bitcoin market, existing Bitcoin that's out there is considered lost. Meaning that, you know, people have died, or like you may have read a couple of years ago, there was a story about a guy in like, I think it was England. He threw away an old desktop that on the hard drive, he had like thousands of Bitcoins that he mined. And so the article that I read talks about how he likes to go to the, he'll like go to the dump and basically dig through garbage trying to find his old computer because it's worth like millions of dollars now.
Jesus.
You know? So, you know, I mean, and now do I want somebody to kill me and my Bitcoin be lost forever? No. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, a lot of times when people steal money from you, especially if we're talking about like warlords and stuff, they're going to kill you anyway. So it's like, hey, if I get to choose, if I'm going to be dead either way, right? And I get to choose, like, I'm going to be dead and then they have my money, or I'm going to be dead and they don't get
Zoom.
Guess which one I'm going to pick?
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is, you know, money is a motivator for some of these unfortunate actions, you know, but now if that gets removed, that's another safety measure, you know, like
sure. And I will say, like, one danger or one thing I've noticed, there are a lot of people in the Bitcoin community, I think, I don't know if it was you that said this in one of the emails that we exchanged, or if it was somebody else, because I've had a few conversations about Bitcoin lately, but somebody made some kind of comment about how, like, oh, like some Bitcoiners view Bitcoin as like the savior of humanity or something like that. And
yeah,
that's true. There are some people that think that Bitcoin is going to like solve all the world's problems, right? Like, I definitely am not of that mind. I mean, I'm a little bit of a pessimist, I guess, or I guess maybe I would probably call it a realist. I mean, just I've lived long enough and I've interacted with enough people to know that there are some people that are just
Zoom.
Like, for whatever reason, maybe they're not deep down, right? Like, maybe they're just really conflicted about
or something.
And it's like, fixing the money problem, fixing our monetary system, isn't going to just magically make everybody like not be in
Zoom.
You know, like, there's still going to be evil people. There's still going to be people out there that like try to exploit people. Sure. Right. I do think, though, that a few of the things that Bitcoin, I think, could potentially really disrupt. I mean, one big obvious one to me, and it would be very hard to get them to do this, but I think it absolutely needs to happen. All government money transfers should be on the Bitcoin blockchain. And the reason why goes back to what we were talking about earlier, because it's all public, right?
Ledger.
And I think so the government should be forced to use Bitcoin, and they should be forced to disclose every wallet that they have, right? So we know every wallet that the government owns, and we could see every single transfer of funds, right? I feel like that would fix a lot of things right now just with waste in our government, because there's so much money that just disappears into a black hole. I mean, hell, the day before 9/11, there was a, so what, September 10th, 2001, there was a report that came out that there was like $9 trillion that the Pentagon couldn't account for or something. I might have been, I don't remember. Now I got to look it up because I'm curious. It's like, my bad. It was only $2.3 trillion.
Oh, man.
So
you're going to get some angry viewers for that one, Dan.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
No, I'm bugging you.
That's pocket change, man. Pocket change.
Yeah. Man, it's just a crazy concept, you know, and it's nice talking to someone who actually knows a lot more about Bitcoin and, you know, just the whole everything about it. You know, it's I'm just like a regular person who doesn't know too much, you know, heard a little about mining, thought about mining, and then tried to find out how to do it. And I'm just like, yeah, I thought I was smart enough, but probably not.
So with mining, a couple of things about mining real quick. So first of all, you cannot mine Bitcoin right with today's technology and the amount of hash power on the Bitcoin network. You cannot mine it with a computer. Doesn't matter. You could have like the most baller gaming rig with like I'm not a gamer, so I'm probably going to get this wrong. What is it? The GTX 1080 or whatever, like the like top of the line. That's probably not even top of the line anymore. You can tell how out of touch I am with that stuff. But yeah, my point is, you could build a $10,000 gaming rig with like the most badass hardware that's on the market.
Yep.
And it's not going to mine Bitcoin. Starting a few years ago, there were specialized mining equipment processors made. They're called ASICs, and they're purpose built to basically mine Bitcoin, or it's not even really to mine Bitcoin, but they're purpose built for the specific algorithm that it's used. I'm not a big expert in mining. I don't know if you can tell, but anyway, the key takeaway though. The key takeaway is that unless you're willing to invest like thousands of dollars in these ASICs, it's really not even worth mining. And especially like you'll see these like cloud mining things where they're like, give us money and we'll mine for you in our data center. Those are all scams, man. Like you're not, I mean, I shouldn't say scams. Like, they're not really scams. Some of them are legit in the sense that you will actually get cryptocurrency back. However, it's minor, man. Like, in my experience, and I won't say that this is true all the time, just because, numbers can swing around or whatever. But in the 7 years that I've been involved in Bitcoin, I found that the best way to get Bitcoin is just to buy it, man. Like, whatever money you were going to spend on mining, like buying equipment or whatever, spend that 10 grand instead of instead of buying 10 grand worth of ASICs, you want to buy 10 grand worth of Bitcoin and just hang on to it. And, you know, you can thank me in a couple of years.
No, absolutely. I think back when I was actually really considering this, it was probably, I don't even know, somewhere between 2010 to 2014.
Yeah, you could definitely mine. Yeah, sure. Back then, I mean, back in 2010, you could mine on a laptop. Didn't even need a dedicated graphics card. You know, you could do CPU mining. And then for a couple of years, it was like you needed a GPU. You needed like a pretty solid GPU. And then since like 2015, I think, is when the first ASICs hit the market. They are, because they're purpose built, they are so much more efficient at what they do that it doesn't make sense to use anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. That is some awesome knowledge. I want to kind of get deep in this, you know, like I want you to tell me two things. Okay. What's the scariest thing that you learned about Bitcoin? And I want you to tell me about, like, what is one of the coolest experiences you can have with Bitcoin that the layperson just wouldn't understand? Deep questions.
Okay. For the second one, when you say experience, you mean like something that you can spend Bitcoin on, or do you mean just like
part of, or just something cool that you've learned about it that, you know, would be something that would be interesting to our viewers, and then be like,
scariest thing and coolest thing, right?
So. Yeah.
Basically two questions. Okay, so I'll start with the scariest thing. We'll do them in order. I think the scariest thing is just like how new it all is, right? Like, I mean, it's even 12 years in, it's unproven. I mean, especially when we're talking about, you know, the US dollar, it's like a couple hundred years old. Gold, we've used gold for thousands of years. Like the earliest recorded history that we have, it's like people were interested in gold because it looks cool, it's shiny, and it never stops being shiny. Mm-hmm. Like, that's cool. You know, compared to those, I mean, even compared to the US dollar, it's just like, it's so unproven and it's so foreign compared to, like, it's different than anything else that people have ever used. And so, and I think because it is dealing with money, right? Especially now, I think like 10 years ago, it's like, nobody really considered Bitcoin valuable 10 years ago. It was pennies, you know, but now, it's substantial. I mean, I would say even that at this point, this is my suspicion. I don't have any hard data on this, but I think that most people in my country probably would not be able to buy a Bitcoin right now. Like, I don't think most people in America have, you know, 19, 20 grand just sitting in their bank account that they could use to spend on something. Oh, yeah. The vast majority of people in this country live paycheck to paycheck.
Yep.
I think the scariest thing to me about that is like, I went hard on Bitcoin, like in these last 2 years, especially, you know, like I said, like I mentioned earlier, I left my job early this year to go work for CipherTrace, and I didn't end up working for them very long because they were not very prepared for COVID. So I got laid off about a month and a half into the job. But when I left and I'm now back at my original company, by the way. So when I left the company though, earlier this year, I cashed out my 401k, and this was before COVID had really hit, by the way. So they hadn't done, I guess, as part of our relief package here, they did a thing where you can waive the penalty for your 401k withdrawal. And so I'm going to look into that, see if I can waive that 10%. But you get dinged with like a 10% early withdrawal fee for your 401k. And so I did that. And my 401k wasn't much, to be clear. I cashed out my 401k a few years ago when I got fired after trying to start a union. I cashed that out just so that I could, you know, keep paying my rent and stuff. And so I had only had a few years of savings in my current 401k when I cashed it out. So it wasn't much. It was like, I think it was like $8,000, something like that, after the penalties and everything. But I put it all into I put most of it into Bitcoin. I put like $7,000 into Bitcoin, and then I spent like $1,000 on silver and gold.
Yep.
Which, hilariously, I'm down on both the silver and the gold, but I'm way up on the Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So I kind of regret that, but, you know, whatever. I'd like
$1,000.
Yeah, whatever. It's not a big deal.
You don't know what happens tomorrow.
So what's scary to me about that is, like, when I said earlier, you know, if I was talking to like a more like traditional investor, I would say, look, at this point, you know, you've got massive companies that are getting into the space. I think that it would be unwise to not have some kind of allocation, even if it's a small one, like I mentioned earlier, like 1 to 5%.
Yep.
I think for me, I'm like 95% invested in Bitcoin. I have a little bit of precious metals. I own some stocks. I have a small 401k that I've been building back up since earlier this year.
Sure.
But the vast majority of my money right now is in Bitcoin. And in some ways that's great because like comparing that to like a 401k, right? If I wanted to say get a loan against my 401k, that would actually take me it's a bit of a process. You got to fill out paperwork, you know, you're basically asking for fucking permission to get to your own money, right?
Yep.
If I want to spend my Bitcoin, man, I could do it while we're on this phone call. I could send you Bitcoin right now.
If you're feeling that way, man, feel free.
Actually, you know what? Do you want to do a little demonstration? I'll send you some Bitcoin. It won't be much, but I'm going to show you the Lightning Network, which is a layer 2 protocol that allows for much faster transactions, right? Like the block time on the Bitcoin, the main Bitcoin network has approximately 10 minute block time. So new blocks are created about every 10 minutes on average.
Okay.
And so when you send a Bitcoin transaction, there's a chance, depending on what kind of fee you pick, if you pick a low fee, it might take a while. So let's say it takes 6 blocks before it actually gets included. That's an hour. And I mean, yeah. I don't know about you, but if I'm at a coffee shop or something and I'm trying to buy a coffee,
that's a bit
too long. I don't wait for an hour before I can leave. I usually just want to get my coffee and leave.
Yep.
Or especially if it's like a drive-through. So the Lightning Network is a decentralized layer 2 protocol that allows for much faster remittances, like within seconds. And so there are a lot of different options for Lightning. Just for the purposes of this demonstration, I'm going to recommend an app that's called Wallet of Satoshi. And you should be able to download that on either the iOS or Android Play stores.
Let's see. Let's try to get the internet working over here. Is there a way to send the money back automatically? Because I don't want to take your money as much as I appreciate it.
No, dude, keep it. I'm gonna send you about a dollar's worth of Bitcoin. I'm honestly not.
Are you sure?
So yeah, hang on to it.
It's gonna grow to 1,000, man.
I was gonna say if it ever ends up being a substantial amount of money, and once the border opens back up, you can buy me dinner up in Vancouver.
Sounds good. Wallet of Satoshi. And is there
speaking of that, by the way, real quick, just a little anecdote.
Sure.
My wife has a little bit of Bitcoin as well. She's not nearly as into it as I am. Obviously, I'm a big freaking nerd. But her introduction to Bitcoin was very similar to mine. In fact, it was from the same person. We went out with my friend and his wife, the four of us. We all went out for dinner. And my wife was about to drop her credit card because she was picking up for she and I. And Patrick asked her the same thing. He said, hey, how would you feel about, you know, having us pay you in Bitcoin? And same thing, it was like 20, 25 bucks worth at the time. That $25, dude, is worth like $700 now.
Jeez.
it might not be exact, but I mean, it's worth hundreds of dollars. And, so like, it's funny to see that kind of stuff, man. And I will say, you know, kind of to go back earlier and add on a little to the question you asked about, like, how has it changed? It definitely makes me think more about like spending money, right? Like when I spend money now, I'm like, well, I could buy Bitcoin with that, you know, and then it could be worth that $1 could be worth like 5, 10, 20 in the future, man. And so like, I will say that I still am a big gadget nerd. Like I buy dumb shit like this GoPro and stuff like that I don't really need, you know, just for fun. Cause I'm into music, I'm into photography, videography. I got a bunch of hobbies and shit and they're all expensive. Sure. But I will say that over the last few years, I've found myself spending less money frivolously because I have more of a savings mindset. I'm thinking that like longer term, you know, planning is more forefront in my mind. So, and I'm sorry, I forgot to answer your other question. I answered one question about what was scary. And I think
go to that one real quick. I just want to kind of follow up on what you're mentioning. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when you're mentioning that, you know, Bitcoin caused you to think long term, I had a very similar experiences once I started going to stocks, which thanks to, I will give a shout out to Wealth Simple Trade. There are some things that you should look up on. So don't just go into it verbatim, but super easy to get started. And you know, it's kind of like Robin Hood for the States, for Canada. And
Yeah, I love Robin Hood. That's what I use Robin Hood for my stocks. And I even have a little bit of Bitcoin on there, even though I don't really like them for Bitcoin. I had like $20 left of buying power in my Robin Hood account. And I was like, there's no stock that I would want to buy for that. I messed around with penny stocks a few years ago. I did nothing but lose money. And so I was like, you know, I'm just going to throw that into Bitcoin. It's almost doubled since I did that. So,
That's fantastic. But, you know, like it's what did I want to say? I wanted to say that once you go into these kind of things, that's what actually shows you about why you should save money. Because, you know, I'm not sure if I can speak for you, Dan, but like prior to me actually going to stocks, prior to me opening like a higher interest savings account just that's just online and has great rates, when people told me, it's like, oh, man, don't worry about it. Oh, it's fine. It's money. That's how you get it. And once, you know, I actually went into this, I'm like, wow, you know, no, I'm going to save my money because even if I'm making 2%, you know, what's the word? Annually or
compounding,
whatever. Compounding interest. It adds up. And before you know it, like that's $20. And $20 might not seem like a lot, but I'm not even investing a lot. And that's like a free meal.
You got to realize too, it's not just $20, right? Because that's the whole point of compounding. So now you're getting, instead of, so let's say you start with $100, right? You got 2% interest. And I know it's not actually $20 after a year, but let's just say it was. And so now you've got $120 and you're getting 2% interest on that. And you know, so it's like, I don't know much about Canadian culture. I have a few Canadian friends and I watch some Schitt's Creek. Those guys are all Canadian, right? But like, I will say that for American culture, we are very, very, and I'm assuming you guys are similar, correct me if I'm wrong. We're very, very bad at delayed gratification. And it goes back to that like long-term planning thing, right? Like we want what we want and we want it now. And I suffer from that too, man. I'm impatient as hell. And when things don't go my way, sometimes I get, you know, I get kind of jerky about it. And it's like, that's a bad attitude to have when it comes to money, especially because like what you think might be like instant gratification, like I feel like that's how we get ourselves in trouble, right? Like, I mean, so many people in this country have a ton of debt, and the reason they have it is because they want the things that, instead of saving for something, instead of saying like, I want this thing that costs 10 grand, so I'm going to save $1,000 a month for 10 months, and then I'm going to go get it. They say, well, I'm going to put it on my credit card and then I'm going to spend $1,000 a month for 10 months to pay it off. The problem with that is that a lot of credit cards are like 20% interest, you know? Yep. And so you're not just paying that 10 grand. And it's like,
And
I won't say that I'm perfect about that, but I've been trying to get better.
For sure. And you know, you don't have to be perfect, but as long as you actually even know this and you know that compounding is great for yourself and terrible if you have it on your credit card, it's huge. And I mean, like just something that I learned recently, which is kind of, you know, not the best thing to admit, but you know, like even I learned that interest adds on every day after you're past your grace period, every single day. And although it doesn't show, it adds on every single day. So, you know, just these little things can make a huge difference. You've reached the end of the recording for this part of the episode, but continue onwards because there is more. Hey everyone, Parham back after another amazing episode with another amazing guest. We hope we added value into your life so you could take the tips from this episode and fuel your process forward. If you enjoyed our episode today and think other friends or family members may also appreciate the lessons that our podcast brings, be sure to share us with them. Subscribe and rate our show so we know how we did. And always remember, trust the process.